Welcome back to our series Around the Horn with UBS Asset Management's Fixed Income Team. With that, glad to welcome back this month's featured speakers, top portfolio managers and business heads from Asset Management's Muni, Taxable Fixed Income, and Liquidity Teams. We will hear candidly from them on their views on markets and what they believe you, our financial advisors, should be focused on within the fixed income space. Joining us for this month, glad to welcome back Anthony Liotti, head of the Fixed Income SMA Advisory Group. Anthony will also serve as our moderator for today. On the panel, we're joined by Dave Balzac, Senior Portfolio Manager for AM's Liquidity Strategies, Dave Rothweiler, Senior Portfolio Manager for AM's Short Duration and Liquidity Strategies, Dave Vignolo, Head of AM's U.S. Corporate Fixed Income Strategies, David Michael, Portfolio Manager for Emerging Markets, Patrick Matevich, Portfolio Manager for our U.S. Multi-Sector SMA, as well as Lisa DiPaolo, Senior Municipal Bond Portfolio Manager. So with that, Anthony, I know you'll moderate today's segment for us, so welcome back. Let me pass it over to you.
Yeah, thank you. Happy New Year, and happy, healthy New Year to everyone. And thank you once again for taking the time and tuning into the EBS Around the Horn call. As you heard, we have a great lineup today. So in keeping with form for these calls, I'll address some macro topics and then turn it over to the PM team for their views of the market and how we're positioning across our solution. So allow me to just take a little bit of a look back onto 24, then we'll get to 25. I think clearly, you know, the overarching narrative for the year was, for the most part, underscored by a robust economy that surpassed so many expectations. Both the employment as well as inflation data clearly stood out for their resilience within the marketplace. The fixed income markets notably saw monthly fluctuations in both price and yields, which were influenced by just a number of economic as well as political factors and, of course, policy decisions. In going back to December, unfortunately, December wasn't the December that so many of us who live within the fixed income world are typically used to. If history were a constant, you know, we would have just seen positive returns across most of the fixed income solutions, just simply supported by, you know, seasonal market technicals. But, of course, 2024 just had to be different. Year-end, fixed income returns across just about every fixed income asset class, though, were positive. But the negative performance of December clearly muted what would have been a much better year. In looking at the Fed, you know, just rewinding again, the Fed ultimately implemented three cuts throughout the second half of the year and closed with a total of 100 basis points of easing. I'd say on my particular, you know, thoughts, I think that was a little bit too much, but, you know, that's debatable. The last cut, which was in December, the market once again turned, I'd say, sharply negative, and the Fed signaled that they're going to be a bit more dovish in 2025. And with that, they indicated just two additional reductions in the Fed funds rate over the new year. Now, currently, the market has gotten, I'd say, a bit more even hawkish on that and is pricing in about just over one cut for the year. Clearly, as we know, these adjustments and expectations will continue to adjust throughout the year. The adjustment that we saw by the Fed and projections, you know, when you look at that, coupled with the uncertainty surrounding, you know, the new administration's implementation for pro-growth, and as we're clearly hearing, what could be pro-inflationary policies clearly factored in to the sell-off, and I'd say it still holds true in today's bond market as we see yields sharply rise. I'd say this, you know, a really interesting data point that has many confused, and this kind of dovetails my good friend who you hear from in a minute shot us a screenshot of this earlier this morning. It was since the first cut by the Fed in September, longer-term yields have risen by more than 100 basis points, right? That is not the norm. But as we sit here today in the second full week of 2025, yields on 30-year bonds are at the highest since 2023, and the yield curve is the steepest since 2020. And if you lived in the UK, boy, yields are at their highest since the great financial crisis. So yields, not only domestically but globally, we're seeing increase. 2024, I mean, look, there are some positives, right? As I mentioned, the vast majority of asset classes managed to end the year in positive territory, which did mark back-to-back years of positive returns. When you look at core domestic fixed income classes, depending upon the duration of the solution, the credit quality, items like that, returns varied anywhere from 1% to, let's say, 8% for the high yield space. EM also. We hear from David Mike here. EM had another good year. But clearly, we would say that investors were rewarded for a balanced portfolio of fixed income securities. And turning and looking to 2025 here, this is the first full week of January. Just really quickly, I'd say the firm, you know, remains or believes that inflation is still on track to hit 2%. But as we can see, the economy stateside remains on solid footing. Inflation continues to remain stubborn. Yes, it's drifting lower, but clearly not as much as many expected. And the employment picture, we'll hear more about that at the end of the week, but remains in good shape. The uncertainties, though, however, surrounding, again, new policy, the deficit, the potential impacts on the economy cannot be overlooked. And that's really what is causing much of the angst in today's market, along with a tremendous amount of just uncertainty. So with that, I will pause there. And like we have done so many times in the past, I will turn it over to the short-term folks. David Walczak, why don't you leave us off here, sir?
Yeah, great. Thanks, Anthony. So I guess just kind of recapping what we saw here in the front end last year. You know, Anthony, as you mentioned, you know, the Fed ultimately delivered 100 basis points worth of cuts in just the last 3 months of the year. You know, I think it is important to also point out that, you know, around this time last year, the market was actually pricing in 168 basis points worth of cuts for last year. So the Fed, you know, ultimately delivered less than that. But certainly there were points last year when the market was pricing in less than the 100 bips that the Fed ultimately delivered. So point being is, you know, clearly there was a lot of change in sentiment over the course of last year in terms of what ultimately the Fed decided to do in terms of easing in the market. You know, looking ahead this year, as you kind of alluded to, Anthony, the market's only pricing in 40 basis points worth of cuts by the end of the year, which would take Fed funds to just over 390. The first meeting with a full 25 basis points priced in is actually the June meeting. So we do have a few meetings here where the market is expecting the Fed to be on hold. And I think, you know, that somewhat is understandable given all the uncertainties that we're currently faced with, most notably in terms of what ultimately is going to be put forth from a policy standpoint from the new administration. So I think a lot of uncertainties for the Fed to grapple with. And as you mentioned as well, you know, I think Fed Chair Powell indicated in their press conference that they'll continue to be data dependent and, you know, look to see how things materialize on the policy front. Looking in terms of what we saw from a money market fund flow standpoint over the past year, as measured by the ICI across the entire U.S. money market fund industry, assets ended the year roughly around $6.8 trillion. So that means roughly about $960 billion flowed through during 2024. And actually a little over half that amount flowed in after the Fed began cutting rates in mid-September. So I think that's that kind of reinforces what we've mentioned on previous Around the Horns, where, you know, it was our sense that we wouldn't necessarily see this groundswell of assets flowing out of money market funds. In fact, we actually saw the opposite occur in terms of cash continuing to come in. You know, looking at just the front end of the curve here from a Treasury standpoint, you know, we have seen steepness emerge in our part of the curve. I know there's been obviously a lot of headlines around just the broader yield curve re-steepening, but we're also seeing it here in the very front end as well. Looking at the spread between 1 and 2 year Treasuries, that's now turned positive, sitting at 10 basis points. It was actually negative 54 basis points as recently as the end of August. So we've seen really since then kind of a steady move steeper in terms of that portion of the curve. The 1 month to 1 year Treasury curve is still negative at negative 13 bips, but it's deeper than the negative 100 bips that we saw just before the Fed began cutting rates back in September. You know, other things that are on the radar for us here in the front end, you know, obviously the debt ceiling is going to be something that we'll be paying pretty close attention to over the first half of this year. Although it will become binding, the debt ceiling that is, this month, as Treasury has done in the past, they'll enact what's called extraordinary measures to basically push off when the X date or the date in which Treasury would run out of cash further off into the future. It's still a little early to pinpoint exactly when that date's going to be, but early indications are at some point around the middle part of this year. You know, we have been encouraged by signs that it looks like, you know, Congress is looking to potentially address that in one of the upcoming reconciliation bills that Congress is looking to put forth, you know, maybe as soon as the end of the first quarter, early second quarter. So hopefully maybe we'll have a little bit of resolution around this and not really come down to the wire. But as we've seen in Washington, really anything's possible. So we'll be on the lookout for that. And with that, I think I'll pass it over to Dave Rothbard.
Yep. Thanks so much, Dave. So again, as Anthony and Dave touched on, since the September 18th FOMC meeting, the Fed has lowered their overnight rate about three times for a total of negative 100 basis points. At the same time, the longer end sold off for an increase of about 100 basis points. So after being inverted for about 2 years or more, the front end has finally become more normalized. And as Dave mentioned, except for about a 15 basis point dip between 3 months and 1 year, the Treasury curve is now almost flat. So what does all that mean from a return perspective? So looking at the B of A 0 to 1 U.S. corporate index, since September 18th at that FOMC meeting, the 0 to 1 has returned a positive 140 basis points. So generically, the front end has outperformed given the curve moves over the past quarter, with no real indication the Fed is increasing rates anytime soon. The ultra short and short duration strategies offer an attractive place to pick up incremental yield. So moving on to credit, similar story again. The corporate credit curve in the front end is pretty flat. Looking at the Bloomberg U.S. corporate indices during 2024, the option adjusted spread between the 0 to 3 and the 3 to 5 year index hit a high of 34 basis points back in March. Then as the year progressed, it hit a low of 11 in December, and now it sits about 3 basis points off that, about 14 or 15 basis points. So the credit curves have become extremely flat in the front end. So again, with that being said, looking at the ultra short strategy, we've continued to focus on the 6 month to 18 month part of the curve. And then the short duration 1 to 3s, we try to favor the 2 year area when possible. Staying with credit, overall employment as well as economic growth have been decent, which supports risk assets. As a result, the new issue corporate market continues to be pretty robust. Some estimates for corporate new issuance for the month of January were around $175 billion. This is only roughly the fifth business day of the month, and we've already hit $75 billion in new issuance and deals, with an average of 3.3 times being oversubscribed, and new issue concessions averaging about 2.8 basis points, which is still a healthy market. While overall credit has been resilient in the front end, there have been some pockets of some spread widening in some industrial names, trading maybe 10 wide to where they were just a couple of months back, which is, you know, at this level, it becomes more in line with ADS spreads. So at this point, it's been a nice opportunity to add A and AA rated industrials when possible. So with that, I'll pass it on to David Dolan.
No, thanks, David. You know, on the investment grade side of the ledger, 2024, just briefly, was a real strong year. I mean, total returns from excess return and absolute total, you know, total returns were positive. Strong corporate fundamentals as economic growth was quite resilient. And the technicals, we just came in probably just under $400 billion for inflows into the asset class in 2024. And that was, as I mentioned, driven by the positive economic growth, but I think more importantly, probably the most predominant driver was the attractive all-in yields for investment-grade corporate bonds that we haven't seen in close to two decades. So that was really the impetus to strong demand and very high degree of comfort for the asset class from a fundamental and technical perspective. But I will say that as we start 2025, we're a little more on a cautionary note, I'd say, to start the year. It doesn't change the fact that the fundamentals are still good and technicals are robust, but I think we're expecting a lot of supply this month of about 150 to 180 billion. And then when you throw on top, as Anthony said, of the macro volatility that we've seen in the Treasury market with yields going up, you know, dramatically since the Fed first raised interest rates, and I saw as of December 1, the 10-year's up about 50 basis points from, you know, that point. So we're talking, you know, basically 6 weeks. So you have a lot of people who are a little more cautious to start the year and kind of waiting on the sidelines. But I think as things start to subside, things will resume once again with strong demand for the asset class as economic growth, you know, remains, you know, roughly 2%. You know, some of the things as you know, President Trump takes office on January 20, some of the things that we're thinking about on our investment grade strategies is that from a sector perspective, we're definitely a little more cautious on the auto and retail sectors because of concerns about potential tariffs. And then on the managed healthcare and the pharma sector, we think there's increased likelihood of more regulatory oversight from the Trump administration. So we're concerned about that, as well as probably we're going to see increased M&A risk in those two sectors, which will definitely present opportunities for us as investors, for our clients in those sectors. But we're being cautious ahead of that because we think there'll be some better entry points as that starts to unfold. And I would say on the positive side for the sectors, the financial sector, the energy sector, and utility sectors are three sectors we favor and have overweights in. And we think those sectors will benefit as well from a less restrictive regulatory environment when the Trump administration takes office. So that's how we're kind of starting the year from a sector perspective. But I will say that in general, with this backup in yields in the Treasury market that we've seen, that's pushed our all-in yields for the corporate market up, you know, into the mid to low fives. So we're starting to get to some very attractive levels from a historical perspective. And I would expect as things start to settle down, maybe toward the end of this month or into February, renewed demand, as I mentioned earlier, back into the space for investors looking to lock in these yields for a longer-term perspective. And then, I, you know, finally, just, you know, overall duration, we're definitely, you know, leaning or neutral to a little bit underweight for our active intermediate strategy. And, you know, we're looking to probably extend a little bit down the road from that standpoint if, when things, as I said, start to settle down, because I think the view of a 10-year Treasury yield close to 5% seems historically to be an attractive entry point in that range. So we're looking to possibly adding more exposure from a duration perspective for our strategies if we start to see that occur. And then finally, from a issuer, you know, kind of a bottom-up perspective, we're looking to, you know, add more high yield exposure into our active intermediate strategy and add more exposure there in the front of the curve as the economy continues to remain quite resilient. So those are the kind of some of the things we're looking at to start the year. But it's definitely, as David Walczak said, it's going to kind of evolve quickly and a lot of moving parts. But I think there's going to be definitely more, I'd say the theme in 2025 is going to be more opportunities, more volatility, and being more tactical in moving around in sector weightings and duration weightings and position exposure as we move through the year. So I'll stop there and pass it on to David Michael to talk about the emerging market strategy.
Thanks, David. Overall risk tone in emerging markets continues to be set by U.S. rates and uncertainty around President Trump's second term. Emerging market spreads tightened by 22 basis points over the last month of the year. That wasn't enough to offset the Treasury widening of 50 basis points. And this left emerging market total returns in negative territory for December. In 2024, EM credit spreads tightened for the year by 60 basis points, while U.S. Treasury widened by about 70 basis points. And that provided emerging market indexes with total returns anywhere from 6 to 7.5%. EM high yield was the largest outperformer, where we saw another year of double-digit returns. That's the second year of double-digit returns in a row. EM debt supply remained really subdued over the last quarter of the year. Melissa left EM with net negative supply of close to $100 billion on the year. This is a very positive technical for the asset class in 2024, and we expect this to continue to support emerging markets into 2025 as investors are receiving more cash from coupons and maturities and less availability of new bonds to put that money to work. Further, emerging markets has been attracting more crossover, non-dedicated flows into the higher quality parts of the asset class. Well, if you look at the retail flow numbers, they continue to reflect outflows from the asset class, but this only captures less than 10% of the emerging market asset class. It doesn't capture the previously mentioned crossover and institutional inflows, which are much larger into the asset class. As we look to 2025, we expect another strong year of returns, similar to 2024, but with more contribution from U.S. Treasuries, and all-in yields in emerging market credit remains very attractive. We see positive tail risks that can emerge over the coming year, especially if geopolitical tensions ease and there are ceasefires negotiated. This would continue to be positive for emerging market risk. The consensus on Trump policy implications on inflation and dollar strength may be challenged, but as my colleagues mentioned earlier, we will continue to see volatility around this. And this underpins the importance of having active managers, not only for fixed income, but emerging market risk. In this environment, we believe these idiosyncratic risks and stories are likely to perform well, especially into 2025. Now let me hand it off to Patrick for an update from our multi-sector team.
Of course, thanks, David. From our end, little change on rates or credit positioning or thinking from the multi-sector desk, that is, over the last month. In rates, we remain neutral to target duration across our book of business. You might call it a patient posture, just waiting for market cross currents to begin to come into better view here early in the year. General thinking near term, absent some material new information, is that we're likely range bound on rates. So think 420 to 5% or so in the 10-year, as David Vignolo mentioned earlier, from an upside standpoint. 470, about where we are now, is a level of interest on the 10-year that we've tested and we failed to breach last April. So quite keen to observe the drama of this week as more of the labor data unfolds and what happens as related to rates. No big changes in credit either. We remain constructive, as noted last month. Fundamentals still strongly supportive. Of course, the economy and earnings. High all-in yields are likely to keep drawing demand on the technical side. So we're content to generally be long here credit. For these reasons laid out, again, across our book of business and in appropriate portfolios. Sector-wise, we continue to reap the rewards of somewhat more striking or interesting exposures that we pair with the sectors my colleagues on this call specialize in. And this would include perpetual preferred securities. These are predominantly from the systemically important U.S. banks, to a lesser extent, a couple of utility issuers in terms of our allocation. Generally boasting quite conservative balance sheets, they're quite highly regulated, and in a sense, that is what better justifies owning the subordination risk inherent in them. The preferreds we own in our shared client portfolios, they all boast QDI, or qualified dividend income. That exacerbates the attractiveness of the tax equivalent yields they afford investors for who are in the higher income tax brackets. And what's more, we're biased to fixed-to-float variable-rate preferreds, the larger portion of this market. These have fared quite well in recent months, as you might imagine, owing to their rate defensiveness characteristics, but they still capture that compression component of pay-for-subordination, which is generally lessened in a year where credit was well-rewarded. We've also gravitated to higher coupon, higher all-in implied resets. That further affords rate defensiveness and basically isolates the decision to be in preferreds to more of a credit versus a credit end duration or credit end rates type exposure, and allows for greater duration and spread duration spend elsewhere in our portfolios. Variable rate preferreds comprise about 8% of the multi-sector bond SMA portfolio, all told. With that, I'll turn to Lisa DiPaolo on tax-exempt municipal.
Thanks, Patrick. As Anthony indicated earlier, the municipal market experienced some pressure at year-end, ending with one of the year's worst monthly returns. December was marked by a volatile Treasury market and more hawkish than expected Fed tone at their final meeting in 2024. So despite the volatility we saw that occurred in 2024, muni Treasury ratios never really became overly bearish. They finished the month of December higher, with the exception of that 30-year ratio. And in terms of just outflows, we did see persistent new outflows within the asset class in December. Looking back, we ended the year with 43 weeks of inflows and 9 weeks of outflows. So when we saw these muni funds and ETFs outflows for the first time, really, liquidity did start to dry up more mid-month, and we did see muni start to underperform during this period. I would say, though, however, despite these outflows for the month, they were offset by an environment of very active tax loss harvesting. that required immediate reinvestment. Supply is robust to start the month of December. We did start with one of the larger weeks of primary supply issuance, $13 billion, beginning of the month. But overall issuance in December totaled $35 billion, so it was a slight increase over the prior year. So just kind of given the strong demand, we saw more from retail and institutional investors, and then just overall elevated demand, it did cause prices to naturally rise. And we ended the year in 24 with total tax-exempt and taxable issuance increasing to record $504 billion, $463 billion of that being tax-exempt. So it was up 37% year-over-year, so another record year. And I would say sectors including higher education and healthcare experienced an uptick in supply just following project delays in previous years. So looking ahead in 2025, the January effect, really lower month of lower supply and seasonally strong January 1st reinvestment dollars is in full force. Projections for 2025 suggest another heavier year of issuance as well will persist. The street right now is forecasting anywhere from $480 billion to high I saw of $745 billion in issuance. A lot of that is just continued infrastructure needs by issuers and current refunding volume, which is adding really just to the supply. But issuance could be impacted if potential tax policy changes impact the status of taxes on bonds and how issuers react to that. We'll have to see. Looking ahead, I'd say 2025, expecting to bring ongoing rate volatility. As the Fed continues to cut rates in 25, we could expect to see a steeper yield curve. Might see more of a demand for longer duration bonds. I do expect elevated muni yields will attract investors, but as we know, monetary and fiscal policies could impact overall demand. Although we would expect a more positive tone for the muni asset class in 2025, as we know, again, several factors, including uncertainty around new administration, changes in fiscal tax policies, you know, a push to extend several key provisions of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, tariffs, proposed immigration policies, all this could impact the market and will be closely monitored on our end. And just looking ahead at our credit opinions in 2025, we do believe municipal credit quality remains stable, just driven by a strong national economy, a softer but stable labor market, and robust consumer spending. We do believe state and local governments are well positioned to weather a downturn, just due to strong reserves they've accumulated over the past 4 years. As of fiscal year 2024, state rainy day funds stand at $156 billion, which equals 13% of spending, and that is a record high. So as revenues normalize from post-pandemic highs, we expect to see pockets of credit stress in that single A and triple B rating categories. So consequently, we would recommend going up in credit quality at a time when credit spreads are all-time tight and threats to muni credits are not fully priced in just due to various factors. In terms of our overall positioning across our strategies, haven't really made any big adjustments coming into the new year. We continue to remain aggressive in sourcing buying opportunities in the market at these higher yields, as we also in December continue to anticipate increased reinvestment pressure, so more or less fighting cash. As we've seen some more normalization in the yield curve and less inversion, we've lightened up a bit, being so heavily barbelled in some of our portfolios, continuing to actively reduce our exposure in BRDN in favor of some shorter maturities, along with more favorable spots in the curve, including that 15 and 25-year bucket. So we are looking to potentially make some, you know, more changes or adjustments in positioning as we move past this month and kind of gain more information in the market. And with that, I will turn it back over to Anthony.
All right. So with that, we are a bit over time. I apologize for the little bit longer, but it is a New Year call, so we're going to be a little bit more long-winded here with a bit more information. I appreciate your patience. Thanks again for tuning in, and we look forward to talking to you next month.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements statements and disclosures that we provide to you about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary or ask your UBS financial advisor for a copy.